I'd like to call to order the Water Quality Supply and Treatment Subcommittee. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Here.
Vice Chair Maggard. Ranking Member Hart. Representative Altman. Representative Basabe. Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Brackett. Representative Cassell.
Here.
Representative Cross.
Here.
Representative Dunkley.
Here.
Representative Gonzalez Pittman. Representative Gossett Sideman.
Here.
Representative Henson.
Here.
Representative Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Redondo.
Here.
Representative Temple.
Here.
Representative Waldron.
Here.
Representative Yeager.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Before we begin, please remember to turn your electric devices to silent or turn them off. Good morning, members. I hope you enjoyed the holidays and welcome back. Before we hear from today's presenters, I would like to make sure I'm back from holidays. I would like to welcome Representative Redondo to the subcommittee. Welcome. We look forward to working with you, and I'm pleased that you've joined us. Today, we are going to be provided an update on the status of rulemaking as required in the Clean Waterways Act, which was passed in 2020. The act passed with unanimous bipartisan support and carries a wide range of water quality protection provisions aimed at minimizing the impact of known sources of nutrient pollution, realigning resources to protect Florida's environment and strengthening regulatory requirements. The act required the Department of Environmental Protection to engage in rulemaking in a number of areas to achieve the goals of the act. And with that, we will begin. We're going to begin with a presentation by the Department of Environmental Protection, and I'd like to welcome back Jessica Kramer, Deputy Secretary of Regulatory Programs at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, to discuss the status of the agency's rulemaking as required in the act. And we will have time after the presentation for questions. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Chairwoman. Thanks for having me back again. It's nice to see you all. I'm excited today to talk to you kind of two pieces here. I want to broadly talk about Senate Bill 712 and the actions that have been taken so far, kind of outside the stormwater space. And then I'm going to pivot into talking specifically about our stormwater rulemaking and the components of that, and go into some of the details of what that rulemaking has resulted in as far as language. Senate Bill 712, also known as the Clean Waterways Act, is landmark legislation that carries a wide range of water quality protection provisions aimed at minimizing the impact of known sources of nutrient pollution, realigning the state's resources to enhance the protection of Florida's environment, and strengthening regulatory requirements. The legislation focuses on remedial action and improvements to regulations regarding septic and stormwater systems, wastewater infrastructure, as well as agricultural best management practices, with the primary components being addressed on the slide above. Additionally, I want to talk just for a second about another rulemaking that DEP is actively involved in, and that is our potable reuse rulemaking. That rulemaking began in 2020, and since 2020, DEP has held numerous workshops, shared an initial draft of language, issued a notice of rule development, and is working on a finalized draft of language. Once that is completed, the finalized draft of proposed language, that is, DEP will be providing that updated draft ahead of a scheduled rule development workshop. Now, also not listed on this slide, there are a host of additional drinking water provisions that are included in Senate Bill 712. I'll quickly tick through those, and I will note that the important thing about those provisions is that once the potable reuse rulemaking is completed, those additional provisions will have a host of edits that will be needed and conforming modifications to ensure that they're consistent with that potable reuse rulemaking. Those include the drinking water standards monitoring and reporting section and chapter, the permitting, construction, operation, and maintenance of public water systems, reuse of reclaimed water in land application. Again, more substance to come on those as they will be contingent on that outcome of the potable reuse rulemaking. During Florida's fiscal year 2021 to 2022 year, DEP adopted several sections outlined on this slide that clarified and amended rules for domestic wastewater collection facilities, which incurred no cost and therefore did not require ratification. These include revisions that were made to 62.6.26.10, which included a requirement for electronic submittal of all non-compliance events through DEP's business portal. Revisions to rules 62.604.100, which updated setbacks and vertical and horizontal separation distances for collection systems, as well as requiring emergency response plans to address hurricanes. Revisions to rule 62.600.410, et al., and again, sorry, all of these are kind of et al. As the provisions are set forward up there. Revisions to 62.600.410 included expenditures on pollutant mitigation and additional reporting requirements related to operations and maintenance. And finally, 62.600.200, which in addition to updating guidance documents as outlined on the slide, also clarified prohibitions on discharges through ocean outfalls, with that prohibition date being December 31st of 2025. And let me just say, as I'm ticking through these specific revisions that have been made, these are all action items that have been completed under the 712 framework. So moving on to biosolids. The biosolids rulemaking process included multiple public workshops and several opportunities for public input. The Clean Waterways Act also required final draft rules to be ratified by the legislature prior to becoming effective. DEP is implementing the new statutory and rule requirements, including working with the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services to enroll biosolids land application in a manner that minimizes irrigation of nutrients to prevent the impairment of water bodies. Nutrient reductions from the biosolids perspective, those are important, and these rule amendments are important for land application of biosolids because, again, they minimize the migration of nutrients that impair water bodies so that the biosolids do not cause or contribute to a violation of the state's surface water or groundwater quality standards. Moving to on-site sewage. DEP has also completed OSTDS rulemaking, some of which did not require rule ratification, some of which that did. These rule amendments establish requirements for OSTDS remediation plans to reduce nutrient pollution if DEP identifies OSTDS to be a significant point source or non-point source of nutrient pollution, which equates to 20% of pollution. And OSTDS remediation plans will also achieve TMDL, so total maximum daily load, loads established within BMAPs and outstanding Florida springs. The second part of the OSTDS rulemaking, which amended 62.6.001, developed and implemented OSTDS remediation plans within BMAPs, again, sorry, basin management action plans, and other priority focus areas. By July 1st, 2025, this would not only require new construction to have an enhanced nutrient reduction system on a lot less than 1 acre in a priority focus area, but also could require existing systems in need of repair or modification to upgrade the ENR. Again, as with all requirements in the OSTDS space, there are variance allowances for certain conditions that folks can pursue if they need. I now want to transition specifically into the stormwater rulemaking. This is, as we've talked about, the pieces that have been completed under Senate Bill 712. When we look at stormwater and nutrient loading occurring from stormwater, we have learned, and it's clear, that nutrients have played a big part in impairing Florida's water bodies. Now, historically, we assumed that nutrients behave the same as other pollutants, and therefore we believed that capturing the first flush of stormwater runoff, the way that we treat for other nutrients, would have achieved at least 80% reduction in phosphorus and nitrogen. The more we've learned, however, the more we've realized that due to factors such as solubility, That simply isn't the case. We have a long history at DEP of working to address stormwater impacts in Florida. However, while the current stormwater rules have been incorporated into our Environmental Resource Permitting Program, or our ERP program, the fundamental approach to how we design systems has not been updated since the 80s. A lot of experts have recognized the need to address nutrients further than what we've done so far. For example, the Blue-Green Algae Task Force is one that I want to point out as having recognized that we need to do more on this space. In response to these findings, the more we've learned, we have undertaken significant rulemaking efforts. These rulemaking efforts have occurred over the last three years, in which DEP has come up with the basis for the rulemaking that would be before you today, and that I'm here to discuss today. These efforts have included holding multiple public outreach meetings, establishing a technical advisory committee, or a TAC, which met 13 times and which published a report of recommendations, and holding four rule development workshops. Now, this walks through a number of provisions, a number of points that are important about the rulemaking, but what I want to do is I want to draw your attention to bullet number three on this slide, where the department worked diligently to incorporate stakeholder feedback throughout the rulemaking process. This bullet references the fact that we, in March of 2023, published a notice of change, which incorporated some of that stakeholder feedback that I'm talking about, and also included four lower-cost regulatory alternatives. While there are some additional finer details, in walking through the rulemaking today, I want to focus on these four categories. I want to talk about minimum performance standards, maintenance and operations requirements, stormwater management system design flexibilities, and grandfathering of existing ERP applications. I'm going to start with minimum performance standards. Now, to determine what performance standards would apply to new stormwater design and management systems, there's a two-pronged approach that would be utilized. First, the applicant would be required to do an evaluation of the expected post-development nutrient loading with pre-development nutrient loading to ensure the increase in nutrient loading that occurs as a result of the developments is not more than the pre-development nutrient loading. And second, the applicant would have to evaluate minimum treatment performance standards for nitrogen and phosphorus, which vary based on the category and condition of the receiving water and are articulated in the rule itself. The second prong of this approach is that the applicant would determine which of the two prongs of the approach is more protective, and that would be the standard that applies to the design of the stormwater management system. This chart walks through the articulated minimum performance standards that are in the rule. That would be kind of that second piece of the first prong. And I want to just give you an example of how this would work. I was thinking, well, that's not going to work. I'll just walk you through it. So if you look at this chart, if you're trying to determine which minimum performance standards apply in an unimpaired watershed, you will go over to non-impaired sites, and you will see that, for example, the minimum performance standard would be a 55% reduction for nitrogen. Next, I want to talk about the maintenance and operation requirements established in the rule. This rule establishes standards including routine maintenance cost estimate requirements, certification of financial capability, consistent inspection requirements for the permittee based on design of the stormwater treatment system. Next, I want to talk about a very important feature, which is our desire to ensure that there are flexibilities captured in the rulemaking for use of best management practices and different design features. This includes flexibility to use existing or apply new site or regional specific event mean concentrations, or EMCs, the ability to choose between innovative BMPs, both those that are listed and not listed in the applicant's handbook, and the use of off-site compensation to meet treatment performance standards. Finally, I want to talk about the grandfathering provisions, which are also very important in this rulemaking. Pending applications, things in motion already, will not have to go back to the drawing board so long as the application is complete prior to the expiration of the 12-month period after the rule is ratified and effective. This will include Florida Department, also grandfathered in would be Florida Department of Transportation projects that have completed their project development and environmental study before the rule implementation. Those also will not need to redesign their system to meet new performance criteria. Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about fiscal impacts. The proposed rule revisions are projected to increase the project of stormwater treatment systems by approximately $1.21 billion over the first 5 years. That breaks down to approximately $242 million per year. This includes the lower cost regulatory alternatives that I talked about before, which were incorporated in the adopted rule and lowered the cost of the stormwater treatment by approximately 16%. Or a cost decrease of approximately $231 million. I wanted to start there because the last slide that I'm going to flag for you today talks about the significant investments that we've made in Florida over the past to ensure that water quality is where it needs to be. What have we spent already to retroactively address nutrients in our water bodies? These numbers are significant. Nearly $2.4 billion in state funds have been appropriated for targeted water quality improvements since 2019. $8.6 billion in funds have been expended for completed and ongoing restoration projects and nutrient basin management action plans. And the total cost rises to $17.5 billion when you look at planned projects and projects underway. Comparing this to the cost of preemptively treating stormwater, taking that more proactive approach of approximately $250 million per year, it's clear that it is much more cost-effective to address these items on the front end rather than wait and clean them up on the back end. Thank you so much for having me today. I appreciated the opportunity to come and talk to you about this rule and happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Deputy Secretary. Is that what it is?
It is, yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the presentation. First of all, thank you for ending with putting that in context, the amount of savings to do pollution prevention first compared to the amount to clean up some of this pollution through other mechanisms. I wanted to go back to slide 6, and that was related to the on-site treatment of sewage disposal, and you had listed a few items that did not require ratification. One of them was setback distances, and although it did not require ratification, I was wondering where that is in the process of DEP updating those setbacks. I think of slide 6.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair.
Couple more. Slide. That one.
There.
Here we go. The first bullet, setback distances.
Thank you for bearing with me through my technical difficulties. Yes, we are still underway with those, taking a number of, I think there's a number of studies. My understanding is that there are a number of studies that are being, that are underway that are going to provide us the information that we need to finalize that rulemaking.
Okay, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more question. So you focused a lot on some of the legislation that passed in a few years ago. I wanted to go back to one from 2016, SB 552, the Florida Springs and Aquifer Protection Act. There was a provision in there that requires DEP to adopt rules that prevent consumptive use permits that may harm outstanding Florida springs. And I was just wondering if you could update us on where you are with that rulemaking, and if any consumptive use permits have been denied as a result of that bill. Thanks.
Recognized.
Thank you. I think we'll have to get back to you on that one. So let me follow up with you on that question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Waldron, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your presentation. This question pertains to, I think it's on page 13, but it's pertaining to the test baseline nutrient loading and pre-development on undeveloped land. How do you, who does the testing, and how does that work in terms of testing the pre-development quality?
You're recognized.
So that'll be testing that will have to be completed by the applicant as they undertake the analysis, which is, again, that two-pronged approach. Give me 1 second, and let me pull that slide up.
Sure.
So that will be in that first prong of the two-pronged approach. That'll be one of the pieces of information that the applicant will need to analyze to determine whether it's that analysis, the number that comes out of that analysis, or the minimum performance standards, which of those is more protective. So there will be things that will guide that analysis, but nonetheless, that will be something that the applicant will need to undertake.
Okay.
How do you determine if it's accurate? I mean, is there any quality check on that, like to make sure it's accurate?
I am going to call up, if it is all right with you, Madam Chair, John Coates, who is with me. He's the director of our Division of Water Management, who can answer some of these more technical questions a little bit more fluently than I can.
Thank you, Mr. Coates. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may proceed, we'll try to follow up and answer the question. I think really of course, during the permit review process, either the water management district staff or the department staff would review the information that's provided. When it comes to analyzing and doing that analysis, as Deputy Secretary Kramer was talking about, of the pre-existing condition, one of the tools that's in this rule that's been adopted but requires ratification is there are event mean concentrations that are typically associated with different land uses. And so that provides sort of a reasonable and an effective and a scientifically based approach for being able to determine what you should expect from those areas. And then, of course, the rule also provides some allowance for people being able to look, and if there's some reason those event mean concentrations really aren't applicable to, say, a pre-existing condition at a site, then there are provisions in the rule that would allow somebody to bring additional information into the application process for review. So it is something that both the water management district staff or department staff would need to review in order to complete and make sure that the permitting was going to result in an effective stormwater system.
Thank you. Representative Baggard.
Thank you very much, Chair. Weber, which one? And I do have a couple, if you don't mind. I'll go through you. On slide 11, you talked about all the meetings that you had. Do you know the number of oppositions to this bill? You know a number that people were against it? I'm just curious how many people got a hold of you at these meetings or whatever and said, I hate this bill.
You're recognized.
Madam Chair, thank you. If I understand, Representative Maggard, the question, to restate, folks who are for the stormwater
opposition,
rule. So we've had a number of stakeholders that have expressed, concerns and questions. A lot of those did come later in the rule adoption, the rule development process. And, the department is still engaged at this point in any questions and concerns. But by and large, we had, as Deputy Secretary Kramer had mentioned, beginning in 2020 with public meetings that were held up front through, a full year, December through of 2020 through November of 2021, a lot of public input. Many stakeholders, of course, want and recognize the importance of these rules to be able to protect and improve what's done under the under stormwater regulations in the state. We have sincerely engaged with all stakeholders, and today most, I think, everybody is understanding of the flexibilities that are provided in the rule, understand the importance of having this rule ratified to be able to protect waterways in Florida. And I hope today that the number of opposition would be zero, but of course I can't represent that and don't know, and I hope that's responsive to your question.
You have a follow-up?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, if I may. I'll ask that question offline. The grandfathering on slide 17, when we have these, I can see this as I've been involved in things like this in the past, these can be very problematic because when does the project what if it lasts into it? what if something changes? You got to modify it. Do you then throw back to the new or go back to the old? How is the grandfathering going to work? Because there's never a black and white answer when it comes to this product.
You're recognized.
Thank you. It's a very good question. It is a lot of wording that is in the grandfathering provisions, both historically for prior times when grandfathering was done, plus certainly in the current case, to try to sort out that question. So, for example, you have a project that is under a permit, and there is some change that needs to be done or some future modification. There is wording that if it's an increase in impacts or a substantial change, essentially, the theme I would offer is that that would trigger revisiting. So if you're really redesigning a project and there's going to be essentially a new project or new impacts, that would have to be considered under the new rule requirements. For those many cases, as you're mentioning, that the project would not require substantial modifications, there'd be no increase in impacts, then you would be remain under the existing rule requirements today. And I think that's important because if somebody is not going back in and doing a lot with a project, they're not going to really have an opportunity to go back and significantly or meaningfully change the stormwater system.
Follow up, please. Thank you for that. Is there a way, when I was on water boards, there was always that what the state called an impact, what somebody else called a substantial impact. Is there a scientific number for that? I mean, my question is, can we tighten up the grandfather enough to say to anybody who's doing this, to say, hey, your project's going to go into this, but you have to modify it because of X. If you increase it by this much, then your new rule, if you don't increase it by this much, you're where you're at today. Because I really don't want to be subjective, because that's when we have issues. Then we start getting phone calls because we're subjective about it. And water should be science, not subjective. So I don't. Maybe there is. That's why I'm asking the question.
Would you like to take a crack at that?
Sure. As I understand the question, we do believe, and we did have a lot of input, public input, during the rural development project process. And so some of the language was pre-existing in February of 23 when we came out with the proposed rule language. And then I think the lower cost regulatory alternatives that we received in response to the proposed rule and then notice of change that Deputy Secretary Kramer mentioned that we published on March 24 of 2023. In that language, we believe it does provide for a very objective sort of drawing of the line to, one of the worst things that could happen is if it was not objective, if it was more subjective, then you might have people going back and forth. And meanwhile, there's a project that needs to get completed.
That's the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we do believe and hope that we've met that mark. And we think that a key to that will be working with the Department of the Water Management Districts also to make sure we're consistently implementing that language throughout the state.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And, since we were gone back to the transition and the kind of implication for users, I wanted to ask, it looks, what is the increase in cost for applying this rule compared to the current rule? You talked about it in, like, you had a cost reduction of 16%, but if you looked at it in, just comparison to the existing rule.
Madam Chair, if I could, I'm going to try to, with Deputy Secretary Kramer's help, and see if we can navigate back to that one slide. Madam Chair, so I think the cost we had put forward here of the $1.2 billion is spread over those 14,000 plus projects that would come over the five-year period that we had to project for the ratification period. And so the cost in one place in our CERC, it discusses, there's certainly a standing cost today to provide stormwater to make sure that there aren't flooding concerns on a site. And what we attempted to do, to the best of anybody's ability, I think, in the CERC process was estimate that what would the additional cost be for this rule beyond the current sort of water quality requirements. And I believe the number was approximately 10 or 11 or 12% increase over what was within the sort of current cost of the overall stormwater systems, the infrastructure, the pipes, the culverts, and the ponds, and the land that would be used to construct those. And then the 16% that's referenced here was our best estimate at the cost reduction from our proposed rule in February to address and respond to those lower cost regulatory alternatives that the department evaluated and incorporated in the notice of change in March of 23.
So it sounded like to me it was when we were talking about it earlier, that it was it's a significant improvement in effectiveness, and for it to be 10 to 11% of the cost seems hopeful to me because as you alluded to, the water's a universal solvent and it's much harder to clean it up than to keep it clean to start with. So hopefully this will be a highly leveraged benefit to our taxpayers who may not have actually been involved in the rulemaking questions, but who will really appreciate cleaner water and reduced cleanup cost, hopefully in the future. I was personally surprised that our systems that we have today aren't more effective. So I'm really pleased that we are moving forward with these rules, the concept of them, and we certainly want them to be cost effective and not have plans interrupted. But it was a sobering for me to realize that even under the new systems that we're putting in now, that we're still backing up. So I want to say this in just layperson's terms. I really appreciate that we will have better systems in the future. We have a few more questions. I apologize. Representative Bell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you also for your presentation. How did the DEP determine the 80% reduction was appropriate for every stormwater system or pond in the state of Florida?
Madam Chair, nice. Thank you. So a very good question and one that I think deserves just a minute to talk through. So for clarity, as Deputy Secretary Kramer presented, not everywhere is 80%. And so there are a number of different factors that I think that contribute to where we are with the proposed rule that is adopted and pending for ratification. So first and foremost, I think the legislative direction in Senate 12 had very clear language to increase the removal of nutrients from stormwater. So the first piece we had to do was sort of look and evaluate and kind of work back to some of the science that indeed drove, I think, Senate Bill 712. What are we currently achieving with our stormwater systems? Some of those systems are achieving somewhere between 35 and 43%, say, for nitrogen. So ultimately, in the proposed rule, we were at 80%. And after the additional input and sort of the late input that we received in, February and particularly March of 2023, the rule that was adopted goes back to 55% is the main case for non-impaired waters for removal of nitrogen and 80% for phosphorus. And phosphorus is fortunately a parameter that is more easy to remove. I think that's large agreement among all the stormwater technicians and the consulting communities that phosphorus is more easily removed. So that's why the focus was on the total nitrogen reduction. So that's at 55%. So in addition to the legislative direction, we certainly, the TAC itself, there's a summary report that was published in March of 22. The TAC members, which span from everybody from home builders through environmental interest groups, the entire, I think, a good cross-section of the stakeholders of the public in Florida were represented on the TAC, and they discussed removal rates everywhere, essentially from 55 up to 80%. It's important to note the TAC didn't reach unanimity on the amount of reduction that should be recommended, but 55% was among that, was among that discussion from the TAC members themselves. Additionally, I think that one of the other important considerations was the practical availability of what kind of tools are in the toolbox. This rulemaking, as we've adopted it, will add more rules, more tools in the toolbox. And if you're going to work with a legislative direction and increase, and today, even in the most challenging cases where there are high water tables and you have an area that, say, maybe the wet detention system, a particular type of stormwater system, would be doing 35 to 43 to 45% removal, you are then talking about an additional 10 to 15% that has to be achieved by either modifying the designs, modifying the landscaping itself, and changing sort of the design approach. And a lot of that can be done and you can get credit for doing what would be considered low impact development techniques. And So the practical considerations of going in and achieving some level of improvement also drove the 55% that we ended up with there. The department also has rules, 6240, that were discussed with the TAC, and those rules also govern what are our directions for minimum performance standards for stormwater treatment systems. So again, Chapter 6240 was a consideration that was discussed with the TAC, you know, even back in early 2020, late 2020, you know, in December when we started, and throughout 2021. And so those, that's another important piece. And finally, I would say the public input overall, you know, drove where we landed with the current percent removal requirements they have in the rule. So hopefully that covers it. I know there's a lot of information, but that's a very important piece. It's the heart of what we're trying to accomplish, to be able to make some meaningful improvements, but something that can be accomplished by industry today.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. What other states have the 80% reduction like the one we're proposing here in the state of Florida?
I think that's something we would...
You're recognized. Right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's something we would want to get back to you on to ensure that we could compile a list that's encompassing.
Representative Yeager, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation today. So in terms of the criteria levels, so are all waterways treated the same? So, I mean, a river stream in the Panhandle versus a river stream in Miami-Dade, are they all treated the same?
You're recognized.
The only distinctions that are drawn are the categorical spaces that those water bodies fall into. And so no geographic modification based on where they're located. However, again, as kind of outlined by this chart, more so the modifications to the minimum performance standards would be driven by the type of water body that you're dealing with. Again, not by the geography of where that water body is located.
One follow-up. So is there a place I can find the specific numerical threshold for each watershed or basin?
You're recognized. I think it depends on the receiving water body, right?
Yes, ma'am. It's going to depend on the receiving water body. And so it will have to be an evaluation that's done by the permit applicant of what water body they're dealing with and whether it falls into one of these categories. And depending on which category it falls into, that'll drive your minimum performance standards.
Thank you.
Representative Overdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions, if that's okay. First of all, when we're looking at your overall cost, going back to, I think it's slide 18 that you had there, and you looked at roughly $2,600 per acre. With that, did you also incorporate the land costs associated with it, the what could or could not be built on there? As I understand it, when you're looking at these and what I've heard from some folks in the public about, they're concerned that it will shrink the area that they're able to use on a property. So $2,600 an acre may be good for the middle of the state, but obviously when you're looking either at a redevelopment project or you're looking at a project that's in a more urban area, $2,600 an acre is certainly not going to really make a dent in it. So could you tell me how you really got to that number and if you incorporated future development costs?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the cost directly of having to acquire additional property was not, you know, included in this analysis. The construction costs of an increased stormwater pond, you know, was included in the analysis. And we've had a number of engineers and stuff that talk about, in some cases, they may choose to increase the size of the stormwater pond. And I think that's a very relevant example that you're mentioning, where you would then have to have some additional land, or you would then potentially set aside some of your developable usable land to service the stormwater need. There are other cases where I think folks have begun to recognize that if you go in there and you apply some of the green infrastructure or low-impact development techniques, that it's not always a given that you would need to increase the size of the stormwater pond. And so I think it will depend on the engineering and technical community of which, you know, I'm a part of, to be able to try to go through and evaluate each project itself. The 2,600 per acre is something that was done, you know, on the examples of the 14,000 projects, and was derived as an average statewide. and certainly in some cases, the land cost will be more or less depending where you are in the state. But the $2,600 itself was the construction costs and the additional treatment systems that would be needed to be able to do the treatment for the work.
To follow up on that, and I agree. I mean, the treating this ahead of time is obviously a lot a better way of dealing with this rather than treating it afterwards and spending the money there. But I just want to make sure we're getting some accurate costs. So, did you also look at there's now a requirement to do monitoring associated with this, and did your cost analysis also look at the monitoring associated with the the stormwater folks that are going to be going out there now and doing that monitoring, or are you just assuming that's going to be handled by the private individual?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The rule itself does not require monitoring of the stormwater discharge. So it is under the same statutory provisions that exist today. Nothing changes with this rulemaking, that once somebody has designed and constructed a facility, a stormwater facility, as long as they operate and maintain that in compliance with their permit, there is not subsequent monitoring that is required of the individual permits. The department and I think a number of stakeholders are committed to the idea that we want to make sure that we are being responsive, and if a particular BMP, a stormwater treatment system, was being credited to, say, remove, say, 50% removal efficiency, then we would separately do science and basically additional monitoring to make sure that if indeed our assumptions about what a particular system is doing should be updated, we would want to do that. But the regulated community that constructs and builds stormwater systems themselves would not have a per-project monitoring cost that would come. They would be, as long as they operate and maintain in accordance with the permit that was issued, they would be in compliance with their water quality requirements.
One last question. I would say to that if they're operating and maintaining, they would then need monitoring to make sure that they're operating and maintaining within the permit requirements. So I think it's kind of a round circle, shall we say, and going back and forth to the answer. But the final question is, you stated in slide 16, we talked about use of offsite compensation to meet treatment performance standards. Could you elaborate on what actually that means and what kind of offsite treatment performance standards there could be?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So in section 9 of the applicant's handbook, the language there, we think it's an important, it's one of the tools in the toolbox. It would allow a project that feels like they don't have space or the ability within their footprint, then they would be able to work with an additional project or stormwater area. And the main, I think one of the most important things for environmental protection is to make sure that one, they have the ability, maybe there's two things. One is they have the ability to design their project in a way and maybe use offsite stormwater compensation, stormwater treatment, to be able to meet the requirements that are increased, but that also that the use of that offsite project would not cause what has been generally termed as hotspots, or areas where water quality is impacted because you have a project that is discharging at one location and a slightly different location you have additional treatment. So there is language in the applicant's handbook under section 9 that both, levels the playing field, allows that to be a readily available tool in the toolbox where it makes sense, but also make sure that we're not causing unintended environmental consequences in the receiving water body.
Representative Altman, you have a question?
Thank you. I had a question on the biosolids. Deputy Secretary Kramer, you mentioned the goal is to minimize the impacts of nutrient loading from biosolids into water bodies. So implied in that, it sounds like an acceptance of allowing biosolids to pollute to bring nutrients into our water bodies. And I know, especially in central North Brevard, this is a whole nother new source of pollution that's coming in from outside our geographic regions. If any amount of pollution or nutrient loading is allowed from these biosolids, that's just increasing the volume of nutrient loading we're seeing in our water bodies that already are receiving, in many areas, very substantial nutrient loading. What is meant by minimizing?
You're recognized.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Allman, a very good question. As I understand the question, the key minimizing is to minimize or reduce any chance for an export of the nutrients that are being, you know, certainly being applied during the biosolids land application process. So one of the important things that was done in that rule development was a requirement for a nutrient, essentially, management plan. And the expectation there is to tighten the requirements so that where biosolids are being land applied, they're being done at agronomic rates, and there will not be excess nutrients that would then be susceptible for runoff and be exported from the site. So the goal, I think, is to minimize or eliminate that.
I like the word eliminate. Yeah. Right. I have a couple more questions.
Of course, Representative Altman, you're recognized for follow-up.
And I know we talked about the percentages, 80% reduction now and some 55% reduction, but I look at that differently. That's a 20% to a 45% failure rate. So if I come in, I develop a piece of property, we're saying you're allowed to only reduce 65 or 80% of your nutrients. We're going to accept that nutrient loading. I think we should be looking at a scenario, or are we looking at any scenarios where we have programs where developers can work from a frame point of not polluting at all? I don't think there's anything in our Constitution that allows people the intrinsic right to pollute. Is there anything that we're looking at from a goal of projects that don't pollute?
You're recognized. Sure.
Yeah, thank you. I certainly understand the concern there. I think one piece that Deputy Secretary Kramer had mentioned that is worth highlighting, you know, to help answer your question, is the rule has this two-pronged approach that was discussed. And the first is a sort of a technology approach, and it says that, you know, basically we in the state of Florida, we're committed to providing stormwater treatment systems that can do at least a certain amount of removal of nutrients that we've all done. I think the world has done a very good job here in the state of Florida to remove suspended solids and the things that we used to think about historically. So when it comes to nutrients, let's commit to having a level playing field, if you will, for the technology-based standard. And that's where that 55% comes in. Every stormwater system that you end up packaging for a particular site in some way should remove 55% at least of the total nitrogen. The other piece, the other prong, is very important. It is a pre versus post analysis that was strongly supported by the TAC members, for example, those representatives across the spectrum here in the state who were participated in our rulemaking. And that pre versus post analysis essentially says that I'll look at a site, when I go in there and the site is what it is today, and I'm going to ask for permission to redevelop that site, make it something more useful, and to make sure in the case of the rulemaking, the pre-versus post-analysis would say, let's make sure that site doesn't contribute additional nutrients to the watershed. And so you have to make sure that the post-development loading of the nutrients are equal, if you will, not greater than the pre-development condition. And so I think that's a very important piece of this, is a commitment to, we know we have impaired waters in almost every county in the state, and to make sure that we're holding the line, and we're also, in some cases, because of the change in the land uses, we're providing a minimum level of expectation for what the stormwater systems will be able to do to protect the water, and as Representative Oberdorf said, make sure that we don't have to bear that greater cost later of cleaning up waterways.
Do you have one more?
Yes. And two, this is a wonderful thing. This is not easy. I mean, what's easy is doing nothing. But upgrading our stormwater rules, I really commend the department for doing that. And Representative Maggie, you talk about everyone. I mean, good question, really, and how many disagreed. I guess we should hope that there's a lot of controversy and disagreement, because to really do good regulation, you're never going to make everyone happy. At least in my 30 years of doing this, I haven't seen that. I know when early on stormwater programs were developed and we started putting in these stormwater systems, I think there was a feeling that, wow, we're going to help protect our resources. And I think we've learned that these stormwater retention facilities under old systems just aren't working. Like, we hope that they would work. I know in our area, they're not. And one of the things that's been a surprise for me is how much they fail because of lack of maintenance. You know, you watch the growth of sod or lawns or blocking the conveyance systems going into stormwater programs, but facilities pushing the water just right back into the streets, and just no maintenance. And this rule is, and it sort of fits into the, I think, grandfathering question too, but in this rule, are we addressing the issue of maintenance of old systems that are not working?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So this rule does not look back. It is not designed to be retroactive. However, one of the important features, and touched on it in a slide, but we think is so vital, is the incorporation of operations and maintenance provisions going forward. And if I may, I think talking about outdated systems, systems that we thought were effective that we've found are not effective, one of the other things that I want to highlight is the desire to provide design flexibilities moving forward. And so it is not only those best management practices that are included in the applicant's handbook right now that could be utilized. It's as there are new techniques that are developed moving forward, those can be utilized as well. And so if there are things that are learned, if we have new technologies that are more effective, there's nothing here that prohibits us from utilizing those or having an applicant that utilizes those simply because they're not specifically enumerated within the applicant's handbook.
Very good. Representative Cassell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the both of you. I always learn so much when we hear from DEP. Still definitely swirling in my head, so I wanted to go back to the pre-development line of questioning that Representative Waldron and Representative Altman touched on. It sounds to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that pre-development applicants are submitting results or means or averages of what we believe to be the nutrient load to be on the property prior to development, but we're also maybe relying on the history of the property to just provide an understanding of what we expect it to look like or what we would expect those numbers to look like. Are we actually getting actual testing and results that we're verifying pre-development and comparing it to post-development?
You're recognized.
So as Mr. Coates spoke to a little bit earlier, it really is a focus on those event mean concentrations. And so those are the numeric values that would be utilized, which are readily known and accepted in the industry as valuable tools to do that very evaluation that you're talking about.
Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up? Are you? Sounds good. Okay. Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the presentation. And I think my colleague kind of asked a question. I really kind of want to know, does DEP have the necessary tools that they need or to really delve into this? Because it seems like we're not exactly getting rid of all of the bad nutrients we'd like to get rid of because we're using, I don't know what we're really using. We're using some kind of a metric that it could be or maybe it's not on these properties before they're developed. So I'm just trying to figure out if you all have everything you need to really make this happen.
You're recognized.
Thank you. I think that we do have the tools. One of the important pieces is, as Deputy Secretary Kramer was mentioning, we do rely on those event mean concentrations. And those are important, and there's maybe two things to keep in mind within. So one, they prevent the need on a project-by-project basis of always having to go out there, which would be timely and have a lot of cost incurred. And it is very difficult to get representative sampling and monitoring of stormwater discharges because you literally have to get out there, you know, when it's raining and when it's coming off, and the concentration is not uniform over time. So there's a lot that goes into that, right? And so the use of event mean concentrations, I believe, is very reasonable. It does reduce the burden on the water management districts and the department on a project-by-project basis. So those can be evaluated. But there is also a commitment to being open to continuing to evaluate event mean concentrations that are associated with a particular land use, so that as the science grows, those are something that now they're in the rule or would be ratified and effective if they're in the adopted rule, and they can certainly be updated over time, and you would update it with when you really take the time to go out and do a sound and well-developed sampling plan to be able to really characterize what's coming off a particular land use. And so it gives an opportunity to include that latest available science into the evaluation, but also keep the burden where we can be an effective agency and our water management districts can be effective.
As you can tell, there was a lot of interest and a lot of questions from the members, and I'm sure they've gotten questions and discussions with interest groups. But I appreciate that you bringing this up. It's stunning that it's been like over 30 years since we've updated these, and the science has moved forward, and this should improve the health of, this should improve the outcomes for Florida's waters, and I appreciate the hard work you put into it so far. And I see no additional questions at this time, so thank you very much, Deputy Secretary Kramer and Mr. Coates as well, for bringing your technical expertise to the group. It was a very informative presentation. Members, this concludes our committee agenda. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Redondo moves we rise, and we are adjourned without objection.